We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Hey, good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning we have a big doubleheader of financial advice, something that we do on the program every month, and generally with one of the three guys who's here this morning, Dave Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business. And for a long, long time, we've been doing these programs on a regular basis every month because we knew that was one of the subjects where people would always have questions. So we wanted to build this as a resource into the program. So he's been here for a long, long time. Also here on the program with us, John Masetich and Kevin Wasby. They both spend time lecturing in finance in the College of Business. And John has his own firm. That's Kensington Financial. It's a money management firm. And from time to time over the years, both of them, Kevin and John, have both been here on the program. And we roped him in all here, three of them together, and they're going to spend the morning with us, the 2 hours, to be a resource for you. Now, we can sit here and talk among ourselves, and we will, but that's not the point of the show. The point of the show is to try to help you out with your own investment decisions, and we hope that you will call in and ask your questions and see what these guys think, and then put that into your big basket of research that you're doing, because obviously one of the things we really want to say is we want you always to think very carefully about what you do with your money. Think about it. Get as many opinions as you can. This is one place that you can get some information. And whatever the question you have, I know that one or two or all three of them will try to help you out. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number. We also have a toll-free line. So no matter where you're living, if it would be a long-distance call, calls on us, 800-222-9455. And we have email. So you can get your question to us that way, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu. Hey, thanks very much, all three of you, for being here. We appreciate it.
Well, good morning, David, and of course, as always, it's a pleasure to be with you. You know, one of the reasons that Kevin and John are joining us is because this is really the kickoff to something called Money Smart Week, which is really, Kevin, I believe, is that sponsored by the Chicago Federal Reserve?
Yes, it is. Chicago Federal Reserve is running its third program now in Champaign County, third annual program. They actually started it 12 years ago in both Detroit and Chicago. Hmm.
And what we're going to do very, very quickly, David, because we do want to take as many questions as possible, obviously, sure, is Kevin's going to just spend a few brief moments talking about the economy, which I think everybody's interested in. John's then going to talk very interestingly about a diversified portfolio. How did it really hold up over the last few years, especially with the tremendous amounts of volatility and all the losses that most people incurred? And then finally, I'm going to spend just a couple of minutes updating the couch potato portfolio, and then we'll jump in and take all kinds of questions.
All right.
Great. Well, thank you. David, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to be with you. A lot of people are asking the question, is the economy on the mend? And is there a sign of a recovery that's sustainable? And I think the answer to both questions is possibly yes. So not to sound too obtuse, there's certainly been some economic reports and corporate earnings that have shown a decent sign of recovery from the past year's debacle. 2008 and 2009, of course, were far from banner years in an economic sense. And as we look forward, we see the beginnings of some signs of recovery. Sustainability is the hard question. Is this enough recovery so that measures that are temporary can be withdrawn and then a more permanent growth in the economy can set in? And I think that remains the $64,000 question. At the end of the month, one of the major federal programs trying to support house sales is going to go away. That's a big question mark out there. Will housing continue to at least hold its own? We still have people talking about a double dip recession. Questions that unrelated to the government stimulus programs, is the economy fundamentally better off? And then there's obviously the ongoing debate in Washington, D.C. about the reform to financial institution re-regulation, regulation, whatever you want to phrase it. So a lot of unknowns, maybe more so than we're used to dealing with. But I think I'm optimistic. At least we've seen the first seeds that might show, at least explain, some of the reason that we don't need to run for the bunker quite as deeply as we thought maybe a year ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Just let me ask you one real quick question, because I think people are also – there's a lot of talk about recovery. When does it start? How long does it take? Do we get back to the point where we were before things went south? And there are some people who are saying things like, well, maybe conservatively we might say by the middle of the decade, 2015, we might be back to where we were. Now, and you can say, well, you think maybe yes, maybe no, who knows. Is that even a useful thing to think about?
It's useful to think about, but I'd say only in pleasant conversation. Here's what I mean. Not to sound too flippant, but when we think about what defines or who defines a recession, let's be honest. If you and I have a job, there is no recession. And as callous as that sounds, it really hits to the heart of what it makes, what it means to make an economy either move forward or not move forward. To that element, if you looked at the national statistics, we're still hovering with a 9.7% rate of unemployment. And then we can talk about the shadow unemployed, how many people are either underemployed or they don't count in the rolls anymore because they literally quit looking for a job. The bottom line is estimates there make the unemployment number all totaled somewhere in the region of 16 to 17%. Until we see a recovery in jobs, I think we're going to have that question continue to be the major question. When will the recession end? You know, I will defer to the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is the official agency designated with determining the beginning of, the duration of, and the end of recessions.
And Kevin, I couldn't agree with you more. Just talk to the 3.6 million households that are apparently going to lose their homes this year. More than half are already 60 days past due, and the other half are already in foreclosure. That's an enormous number. It still isn't really settling out. It just continues to escalate. So again, when we talk about when will the recession end, the better question is, how is it impacting me? What kind of victimization am I part of in this process? And for some, there is no recession, but for an awful lot of people in this country, it's just tremendously debilitating.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I know that, you know, one of the things that Dave and I'm sure that all three of you, anytime that you'd been here, one of the things that we talk about year after year is arranging your investment in ways that tries to cushion the big bumps up and down.
No question. You
know, having a well-diversified investment portfolio, that's the idea. And I suppose different people, you ask them, well, what does that mean? Maybe they have slightly different ideas, and we have one. It's the one that our website, and we'll talk about. But I think that John wants just to talk a little bit about how if you were well-diversified, well, how would you have come through this period we've just come through?
Yes, thank you, David. I'd like to address that. I did some research yesterday on the Internet, and I didn't start in the year 2008, which is when this whole debacle started. I believe, you know, it started maybe September of 2008 with the collapse of Lehman Brothers. I went back and I looked at when did markets worldwide, stock markets, actually peak. It was actually October 5th, 2007. So I did some measurement from that date, and I took it, my rate of return calculation, through yesterday. And here's the interesting thing. If you were totally invested in stocks, and let's say you had a stock mutual fund that maybe more or less mimicked I use the Vanguard Index 500 fund as a proxy for the stock market. You could have used the Dow Jones on this too. And the answer is, through October 5th, 2007 through yesterday, one would have lost about 18%. including dividends paid and dividends reinvested, so 18%. However, if you had a little bit in the bond market, bonds, I looked at the average bond fund, and over that same period of time, about 2.5 years, bonds are up about 25%. I emphasize a positive 25%. Mm-hmm. So let's say that you had a 50-50 asset allocation between stocks and bonds, kind of a traditional split. Your weighted average return would have been a positive 3%. And if you look at another thing you could look at would be another proxy for a balanced fund would be the Vanguard Balance Index Fund. To me, this is my proxy, and this is how I actually measure myself when I report results to my clients who are very, you know, numerically oriented as I am. And over that same period of time, the Vanguard Balance Index Fund lost about 2.8%. So in other words, you know, we have the greatest debacle we have seen since the Great Depression of the 1930s. And if you were, you know, 50-50 or 60-40 between stocks and bonds, you maybe lost a few percent, or you broke even, or possibly you even made 2 or 3%. So I think the huge mistake that investors made during this last downturn was that they just went too far out on the risk curve. They just had too much in stocks. You know, or those assets that have inherent risk, like, you know, commodities, real estate, stocks, they just didn't have enough cash and bonds. They violated, you know, just a basic traditional asset allocation tenet to be diversified. And if you had, let's say, a very conservatively balanced portfolio, say 30-35% in stocks, and say 60-65% in stocks, real estate, commodities, things like that, I calculated that you would have actually made about 12% since October of 2007. So did diversification fail this time around? I would argue vociferously it did not fail. People just went, they just took too much risk. They got caught up in the whole euphoria that stocks could only go higher, that real estate could only go higher. I especially saw this in San Diego where I live. You know, cocktail party talk 3 years ago, 4 years ago was how much money am I making on my house? Isn't it wonderful? You know, will it end? Of course it won't end. And any fool should just put all their money in San Diego real estate or real estate in any major metropolitan area, and you can't lose. Okay. Well, I don't hear that kind of talk anymore. Yeah. You know, so there was... Yeah. If someone really took a bath during this last downturn, I feel sorry for them. But there was really no excuse for not being diversified.
Okay.
And just jumping in there just for a moment, David, a lot of that lack of diversification unfortunately happened with people in their retirement plans, in their IRA plans, in their pension plans, in their defined contribution plans. Maybe they were 401k plans, and they were typically far, far overweighted in stocks during that period of time. And this is very unfortunate, obviously, for people approaching retirement, because the worst possible thing that can happen is, one, you want to retire, then, two, you need to take money out of these funds, and especially when the stocks have been tremendously beat up. It's just very, very debilitating.
Well, I know one of the things that we have talked about quite often over the years is periodically you need to look at where you have your money, look at where you are in your life, make some and do some assessments and say, okay, is it going the places where it should? And there seems to be some fairly standard, you know, easy back the envelope ways to think about where I am, how close am I to retirement, where do I have my money, and particularly how much should be in equities and how much in fixed income, but then also in bonds. And that's one of the most sort of basic things that maybe financial planners try to get across to people. And what is that? And I guess maybe, again, we go back to the question, well, why weren't people trying to at least pay attention to one of the most sort of basic rules about asset allocation?
Yeah, I'd like to pick up on that. You know, the academic studies are pretty conclusive on this. The one that everybody cites, I think the author was Gary Brinson. And the study was updated a couple of times by other people. And that study showed that your asset allocation actually determines about 90% of your rate of return, whether that return is positive or negative. It's about 90%. And only about 10% comes down to your ability to time the market, going in and out of the market, and picking...
Select stocks.
And select stocks, security selection, as it's called, which can either be positive or negative. So, and again, this last time around, based on those figures I just cited, once again, it proved to be true. if you were way over invested in stocks, say 80, 90, 100% of your portfolio, you really took a bath.
One other way of looking at this, David, and something I talk to my clients about is I like to have a lot of ammunition on the sidelines. And that is that if stocks go down, they are not put in a position where they have to sell stocks. And historically, with very rare exception, if you have dry powder on the sidelines, in other words, approximately 3 to 5 years of cash on hand to deal with expenses over the next 3 to 5 years where you don't have to hemorrhage, you don't have to go in and sell stocks, you're in pretty good shape. So you really need, in addition to an intelligent asset allocation model, you really need to have that dry powder. You really need to have that cash in money market funds, in very, very stable types of investments that are dollar for dollar, where you can access that and not have to sell stocks.
And how many people do you think would even have half that or a third of that?
Well, if they don't, they need to continue to try to build those cash reserves and at the same time have a more conservative asset allocation.
Okay. And then I guess also, though, when you take a look at the positively feeble rates of return that now you can get in the instruments and the things that are set up to do that, I'm sure that people look at that and they're really unhappy and they say, well, that rate is so bad, but I can do better if I go over here.
Well, remember, and there's no question that rates are extremely low, and what this has enabled banks to do, and the government de facto has bailed out the banks because the banks are paying us, what, 0.25%, 0.5%, turning right around and not really loaning that money back to us, but going out in the treasury market and picking up 3.5% to 4%. And this is really rebuilding their capital at our expense. There's no secret about this. It was the lead article in the New York Times just this morning. So that's a fact. But you have to think about this cash as a hedge. I think of it as more of a hedge against ameliorating the impact of stocks in a portfolio as opposed to just the rate of return that I'm going to earn on that. I don't know how you fellas feel about that.
I think that's a great point. And one of the things that I'd like to kind of tie this back into the Money Smart Week theme, we've talked about investment rates of return. We've talked about asset allocation. David mentions, you know, the kind of rates of return that, as you brought up, safe money, cash, CDs are earning. Those kinds of things all, to me, we need to back up and look and say, well, how did I get that money? The bottom line is, before we really start talking about investment rates of return, we've got to have a good savings plan, a good management plan. We've got to look and say, you know, there is a long-term process here that I need to employ. And the first step in the process is I need to save money before I can invest and then expect an investment rate of return on my money. That unfortunately is difficult to get out of unless you're the beneficiary of a trust or an estate.
Yeah. We're here talking this morning about financial planning and investing. This is something that we do every month here on the program. We have three guests. All of them have been on this show before to do this very thing, and we got them all together. We've got a big panel here, and between the three of them, I think that they should be able to handle most questions, and we hope that there will be questions. We have somebody ready to go on the phone. I have an email I want to get to. Before we do that, though, we need to take a moment to have one other sort of financial pitch, and we need to do a little musical chairs here if... We don't have enough microphones here, so Kevin Waspy is going to bravely give up his seat to Dave Teal, who's the program director for WILL-TV, who has been here with me a couple times this week, to try to persuade people to take some of their money and make a different kind of investment with it. That's the way we're going to spin it, because when you give your money to WILL, you're making an investment that will return you as a dividend programs, great programs, all throughout the year. Here, because folks like you support it with your dollars. And that is what we're asking people to do.
Yeah. And, well, I'm hoping that, you know, if we reach our goals, we'll be able to buy a fifth microphone for the studio. But
maybe. We'll see.
Yeah, it's very crowded in here today. But, no, I do want to say, you know, this is the last morning that we'll be asking for your help during Focus. And we really hope that you value this program and that you will make that effort this morning to call us at 217-244-9455. We set a goal during this drive. We wanted to hear from 1,000 listeners. I'm told we're at about 790 and change. So we want to push up over 800 during this program. That would be great during this hour. And then we still have another hour of focus to come. So it's just so important that we hear from you because, I mean, in the current financial climate, which, as we know, is not good, we've taken our lumps, as have a lot of people, and we've had to make some cuts and, you know, hopefully won't have to do that again. But, you know, you really have the say-so in whether, you know, that will happen or not. 217-244-9455 is the number to call.
Yeah, or you can go online, and a lot of people have been doing that. It's willpledge.org, and we'd be very happy to take that as a credit card contribution, or you can do it the old-fashioned way. You can call and you can send us a check. People have been hearing us, I'm sure, all through the week talking about this. We're now coming down to the wire of this spring effort. This is kind of it. This will be the last time on Focus we'll have an opportunity to talk with folks. So if that has been an item on your to-do list for the week, we hope that you would get that taken care of now and head into the weekend, and you could say, yeah, I did my bet to help support programs that I use. You know, I expect that it's going to be there when we turn the radio on. And the reason that we can be here is because folks like you listen and also contribute.
Yeah, and we really like to hear from you right now, so don't put it off. Thanks.
Hey, thank you very much. We are here this morning taking your questions on investing and money management. This is our monthly show on personal finance. We have three guests with us. Dave Sino, who's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business. Kevin Waspy, he's a lecturer in finance in the College of Business. And John Masetich, he's an adjunct lecturer and occasionally is here to teach. And also, he makes his home in San Diego, where he has a business, Kensington Financial, a money management firm. And whatever questions you have, I know these three guys are going to do their best. And I wanted to get this caller in, and we will come back and also just update people on the Couch Potato portfolio, which has been updated on our website. So you can go there and you can see where it is now. And I think Dave would just like to say a couple things about that. But why don't we go and take our first caller here, someone in Urbana, and they're on line one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for your program. It's extraordinary, and I'm grateful to be WILL supporter. I'm kind of curious on two things, because when we talk about the recovery, I'm afraid that people are ignoring the fact that this recovery, by having people losing the immense amounts of value in their homes, we have wiped out generations of savings that no one is in a position to replace. And I think that this recovery is going to be a lot slower because we don't have the muscles, we don't have the legs to stand on that we did in prior recoveries. We just don't have that investment. So I'm very concerned when I hear people looking for blue skies, because this has been a lot more mortal wounding than we've experienced in the past. The other thing I would like to hear from your experts, my 401k is now a 0.41k thanks to the losses that we've had. And I'm curious if there is any kind of self-directed retirement device that doesn't link me to my company investment for match and things like this, because I would have actually done better if I had taken the money and stuck it in my mattress at this point. So I'll hang up, and I'll look forward to hearing your answers.
All right, thank you.
Let me jump in on the second question with respect to the 401k. Some people call them a 201k, a 101k, and now I've heard a 0.4 401k. Haven't heard that one before. Mm-hmm. And the question is, are there other retirement vehicles that are available with your money as opposed to simply putting money into a 401k? Now, I would caution the individual who just called in, because if there is a match from your employer, it's very, very difficult to leave that money on the table, especially if you are likely to be vested, which I'm guessing the caller is because he's probably been at his place of employ for some time. So what I generally recommend to people is, number one, to continue to contribute to that 401k at least, so you maximize that match. Even in the 401k, and I'm certain that your 401k has some fairly conservative choices. For example, many of those choices might be a GIC, a guaranteed investment contract, a money market fund, a short-term bond fund, which are pretty conservative, low-volatility types of investments. Those are certainly choices. Then, after you have at least put enough money in where you have gotten the contributory match from your employer, then, if you have excess cash, then take a look, for example, at a Roth IRA. That may be a possibility. Now, one of the problems with a Roth IRA is you may run into an income limit, and that is that if you are making too much money, that you may not be able to contribute to your Roth IRA. So that may be an issue. Alternatively, if you are not able to contribute to a Roth IRA, then you have the opportunity always to take after-tax money, essentially, and use that money and put it into a diversified portfolio. It might be something as simple as a couch potato portfolio. It might be far more complicated in terms of an asset allocation, something that John talked about just a few minutes ago. So there are all kinds of choices. By the way, if you are looking at a Roth IRA and you are married, your eligibility to participate in a Roth IRA doesn't really phase out until you are somewhere in excess of about $167,000 of adjusted gross income. So as a result, most of us are able to place money into a Roth, and that amount of money each year, at least under current law, is $5,000. So you could invest $5,000 in a Roth. And if you're an old person like me, that means that you are over 50 years of age, you can add another $1,000. So there is $6,000 of additional funds that you could place inside a Roth IRA. You could go to any plan sponsor, whether it's a mutual fund company, a brokerage firm, an insurance company, or even your local bank. But I would caution the listener, I'd be very concerned to leave money on the table. So make certain that you at least put enough money into that 401k so that you get the maximum match. Did you want to add anything to that, John?
Yeah, David. Also, caller, also just consider a traditional IRA account. Where the phase-out rule is, if you're married, $89,000 to $109,000 on your adjusted gross income. And if you're 50 or older, you can do the $6,000. Also, if you have a little side business, you can set up a plan for the self-employed called a KEO plan or a profit-sharing plan. And going back to the first part of his question, I would just like to say that I think I agree with his sentiments that we're in a new economy. And there's a buzzword going around that I like. It's called the new normal. I don't know who coined this phrase, but Bill Gross at the PIMCO Group in Newport Beach has been popularizing it. He and his sidekick, Mohammed El Arian, they're a very good bond group and investment group in Newport Beach, California. They call it the new normal, meaning that the wealth effect is taking over. People have lost a lot of their wealth because of the downturn in their real estate and their stock portfolio, so they're going to spend less money. Well, consumption is 70% of the GDP, so if they spend less money, 70% of GDP, we're probably going to have a lower GDP rate. Growth rate, we're probably going to have a higher unemployment rate, and therefore probably corporate earnings are not going to go up as much as they did in the past. And if corporate earnings are subdued, they still could be going up, and they probably will go up, but they will go up at a lower rate. That means probably we're going to have lower stock prices in the future. So I would agree with that sentiment. We are in a new normal.
Okay.
Just one last thing, and that's speaking to the past performance of the 401k. I think everyone that has an employer-sponsored plan, particularly where they're allowed to defer their own income into a 401k plan, is exactly that, really needs to do their homework in their asset allocation. So there is some menu of investable choices that each participant needs to make, and setting those allocations is not done by talking with your coworker. It's done by thinking through your performance, risk tolerance, capabilities, your goals, your search, your circumstance outside of the company retirement plan. And it's not just a question of, well, you know, I'll just do it like Jake did.
No question. And also, under a 401k, an employer is under certain affirmative obligations to provide investor education. That's very important. So there needs to be good materials available on that veritable menu of choices. And indeed, that menu of choices under the law has to include short-term investments, long-term stock investments, both U.S. and international investments. Typically, there is a proxy. A money market. Typically, there is an S&P 500 proxy, et cetera. So it's important that the employer has received good fiduciary advice and is providing the kinds of choices that are now required under the law.
Okay. I have another caller here. I have several emails. I hope the caller won't mind waiting just a second. I want to at least try and get to some of these emails in the order that they came in. The first was we have someone who would like you to talk a little bit about investing in index-based exchange-traded funds, ETFs, versus mutual funds. Are they essentially the same? Is one better than the other?
Well, I'm going to defer to Kevin because Kevin, for example, I know trades in ETFs and I can talk about them. But Kevin, why don't you go first and talk at least talk about ETFs?
I think for the average use, an ETF is superfluous. An exchange traded fund is, imagine a mutual fund that trades like a stock. In other words, you can buy and sell it any time during the day, as opposed to once each day at the closing price after markets are closed. Mutual funds have less liquidity because the ETF is trading moment to moment like the shares of IBM stock. But then I have to ask, well, why? Why do you need that amount of liquidity? If we're really looking at investment, we don't need that amount of liquidity. And with many ETFs, what's known as the tracking error, what the performance of the price of those shares actually does as compared to what they're trying to index is very huge as compared to index mutual funds. The second thing in the favor of index mutual funds is the expense ratio. John Macedish has mentioned Vanguard Group of Funds. They are the premier sponsor of index-type mutual funds with the lowest overall expense ratios you can find. So bottom line is, for investment purposes, don't worry about ETFs. If you're going to talk about a trading strategy, there are some ETFs that might fulfill on that. One might be a short-term move in the price of gold. So there's a gold ETF or two that do decent things with that. Another might be a short-term interest rate play. There are a handful of ETFs that are available for that. But outside of those rather short, when I say short-term, I'm talking, you know, an 18-month move at most.
And ETFs also, Kevin, are they not often used by traders day-to-day and hour-to-hour and minute-to-minute, and they become very volatile? And if you're a long-term investor and suddenly see that big move, you might be spooked, if you will, mm-hmm. into selling at precisely the wrong moment and taking a big hit.
Exactly.
I'll say, and I agree with Kevin and David on that, but I'll mention one favorable thing about a specific ETF. There's one that tracks the S&P 500 fund, and the trading symbol is SPY. And it's really like the Vanguard Index 500 fund, which is an open-ended, you know, index fund. The advantage with SPY, and there are a few others like that, is a lower expense ratio. I think SPY is about 0.10 or maybe 8 basis points, whereas the Vanguard Index 500 fund is
about 11.
No, I think it's 0.18.
Is it 0.18
now? 18 basis
okay,
points.
18.
So there's a slight advantage if you stick to that bread and butter SPY, but otherwise I agree with the other sentiments.
Okay. Let's get another caller here. We'll go to Urbana Line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
It's a great show that you show it. And I have a question going back to IRA situation where inheritance and that sort of thing. Like, I understand that IRAs flow gently between spouses. If one passes away, then the IRA becomes the property of another.
Correct. That's spouse. Almost like a spousal IRA, yes.
But what should a spouse do then when if if the one passes away and now there are children involved, how can those IRAs be set up? I've heard of something called a multi-generational IRA. Is that a real item? Is there something you can say about how to arrange things so that children don't have to go through, you know, extracting money?
Well, there is an opportunity when you would pass away if the children elect to have the IRA treated as an inherited IRA.
Mm-hmm.
And in certain circumstances, if the IRA is properly set up, the children then can take that money out over their life expectancy. So let's say that an elderly parent passed away and that elderly parent had not drawn money out of the IRA and three children were equal beneficiaries of that particular IRA. If the three children agree to have it treated as an inherited IRA, then essentially three subcategories would really be set up, and each of those children would then take that money over their life expectancy.
Mm-hmm.
So that is much different than if you simply are a beneficiary of an IRA, you suddenly pull that money out of an IRA, and you pay income tax on it at that period of time. So, but the rules are slightly complicated, and you have to work with a plan sponsor who understands inherited IRA rules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't found anybody around yet who understands. They look at me like, what are you talking about?
Well, I'll jump in on that one. Call Vanguard.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And ask specifically for the retirement planning department. I'm not on the payroll of Vanguard, but, you know, I've got half my client money in Vanguard mutual funds, and I talk to them every week, and they're wonderful at helping you through these technical matters.
And so there's a retirement?
Yes, call the 800 number at Vanguard and just ask for the retirement planning department.
Okay.
I deal with them all the time. I've got my self-employed plan there, and I've done a number of IRA rollovers when a client of mine would pass away, and then the spouse would inherit that IRA fund. They typically would do an IRA rollover into their IRA.
Sure.
And then at that point, it's good to revisit the beneficiary issue. Okay, now the money is rolled into you. Let's say your spouse passes away. You now inherit the money. You do an IRA rollover into your IRA. Now look at who are the beneficiaries. Revisit that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And think, is this the way you still want to keep it? I mean, it's up to you. You can change it at any time in terms of who the beneficiaries are.
If there are, as you said, maybe three children, would it be better to split the IRA into three separate?
That's what I recommend.
Uh-huh.
That's what I recommend, because then each child who's a beneficiary will have the opportunity, if they are three separate IRAs, to make that election.
Mm-hmm.
One election may be, yes, I'd like to treat it as an inherited IRA and take the money over my life expectancy. Or in the alternative, no, I really need that money today. And yes, I do understand that there's going to be an income tax impact, but the net money after income tax, I desperately need to pay off my home loan or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it is better to set it up as three separate IRAs.
Mm-hmm.
And David, let me just ask you a question on that. Suppose a child just wants to put the money in his IRA and just keep it as an IRA. Is that allowable without taking a payout over his lifetime?
If it's an inherited IRA?
Yes.
No.
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 Okay.
Can't do that.
Either cash it out or you take it over your lifetime.
You're going to have to do – right. And there's a third election, but that's more complicated. It's called the five-year election, and some people are eligible for it and some people are not, depending upon how the IRA was previously treated. But now you're going to get the very, very complicated issues.
All right. That's a bag of worms. Okay, thanks.
Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus. We will, however, be hanging on here with our three guests, Dave Sino, Kevin Wasby, John Masetich. We'll be here also for the second hour, so that should allow us plenty of time to answer questions. We'll continue to take calls and emails. The email, by the way, is will-talk, so that's will-talk@illinois.edu. We also do have that the old phone numbers, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think, Dave, did you just want to get in a mention of the couch potato?
Well, that's right. I can do that. And I also had a couple of emails that were directed to me that
I wanted
to talk about
as
well. In a nutshell, as Harriet Williamson just pointed out, the couch potato portfolio has been updated on WILL. And if you'll recall, it consists essentially of about eight, as it turns out, Vanguard stock indexes, We have the S&P 500, of course. We have small cap value, small cap, international. We have REITs. We have all kinds of items, and it shows you the asset allocation. Now, recall that it is a stock set of indexes. So in terms of this is a 100% pure stock index allocation. And I'm not suggesting this for anyone that 100% of their money should be tied up in this particular type of portfolio. But in any event, we like to compare it. We like to follow it on a monthly basis. And at least through last night's close, the portfolio for the year is up 10.64%. And that compares to the 9.25% of the S&P 500. So we're running a little bit ahead of the S&P 500, about 140 basis points, 1.4%. So, and we like to track that. And John, just like you like to track the balanced portfolio, mm-hmm. I think that's very, very interesting. We're tracking for this one the S&P 500. Last year, we ended up about 450 basis points better than the S&P 500. We're running about 1.25 ahead. But interestingly enough, if you look at the returns this year in this portfolio, U.S. is clearly leading international. International is getting beat up for a whole lot of reasons. And Kevin, I know you're the expert on international, much more than I am. Maybe it has to do with currencies, et cetera. But no question that U.S., at least this year, is a better place to be investing.
So far, so good. Yeah, we've seen a lot of unexplained issues in particularly Europe. Everyone's read about the problems the country of Greece is having, the possibility of Spain, Portugal, perhaps a handful of other smaller countries in the Eurozone might be having. The bottom line is I think we'll see the U.S. markets probably outperform there because it generally seems like they're about, I would say, 9 to 12 months behind us in many kind of economic movements. So the Eurozone is still going through its own version of funk. When you get outside of the Eurozone and start thinking about the Asian economies, obviously, China yesterday reported tremendously strong growth. The issue in the Asian economies now is the overheating potential. I think stock markets throughout the Asian theater have been a bit cautious over the past couple of months because of that. They did have a good recovery coming out of 2009. And now the question is, will China step on the brakes? Will they slow growth in the Asian theater because they're concerned about inflation?
Okay. And then one other issue, if we have time during this hour to address, was an email that asked, how can the average person find out about the condition of their local bank? And given FDIC protection, how does the condition of a specific bank affect the safety of my checking account? How does it affect the safety of a trust account? And what would you recommend I do to protect myself and at the same time support my bank? I think those are very, very legitimate kinds of questions. I had some time to think about it. And the first thing I did is I said, well, let's go to the FDIC website because it is just a wonderful source of information about every bank in the United States as well as FDIC kinds of protection. And that website is basically FDIC.gov. So www.fdic.gov. And if you want to really understand FDIC insurance on deposits, just add a /deposits, and it will tell you all about FDIC coverage. And I had to sort of review that for myself. And I'm just going to spend just a minute or two talking about that, because what the FDIC does is they say, look, you can have different kinds of accounts. For example, you could have an account just in the name of David Inge or Kevin Waspy or David Sino. An individual account at Bank A, at least currently, is insured up to $250,000. So if I had if I had a CD in my name, if I had a checking account in my name, and I had a savings account in my name, I'm insured for a total of $250,000 for just accounts just in my name. Now, at the same time, if I am married, all right, so let's say it's David and Carol Sino, we could have a joint account, which is a completely separate category, and we could have as much as $500,000 jointly. And again, in Bank A, so Carol has $250,000 of FDIC coverage in her joint account. I would have $250,000 of joint coverage in my account. So now we're up to $750,000. And Carol, for example, could have a single individual set of accounts just in her name. So you can get up to very, very large sums of money. You can also do trust accounts and POD or paid on death accounts. And the truth of the matter is, if you were fortunate enough, you could do business with one bank and get up well over $2 to $3 million, depending upon the number of beneficiaries you have in your trust accounts, your individual accounts. And oh, by the way, retirement accounts are a whole separate category. So in addition, maybe I have a 401k at my bank or an IRA at my bank. And again, that would also be insured myself for $250,000. And if my spouse had that for $250,000. So there are all types of ways to have very, very substantial coverage at one particular bank, especially if you wanted to support that one bank. Now, if you wanted to find out information about that bank, again, you can go to the FDIC website and then click on Bank Find, F-I-N-D, and then you can find out all kinds of information really current through the last calendar quarter, 12/31/09, and you can break it down into even individual branches. Kevin, there's just, I know that you look at this stuff a lot more than I do. There's just a veritable panoply of information.
There is, and it's amazing that more people aren't aware of it. I find myself saying this to students time and time again when we talk about looking at the economy, looking at different investment opportunities, looking at segments of the economy for indication of growth or not, or so on and so forth. I mean, the banking industry and this and any developed economy is basically the grease, the lubricant in the economic system. If the lubricant isn't there and isn't working right, the economy is not going to be performing optimally. It may not even be performing at all. So I'm with you. I like to look at the condition of banks. I like to do business locally. And I would say that a person will know that they do have the FDIC insurance. But to me, that's not an absolution. I don't look at the FDIC insurance and just say, I don't care what condition the financial institution is in. I'd rather know both. I'd rather know that I have an insured deposit and that the bank is being managed well.
Well, just we're at the point here. We're going to have to take a break, and we can come back and talk to some other about these other things later. Just real quick, I guess, as you were talking, I was thinking, well, what this says is that you could have quite a significant amount of money in a bank, and because of the deposit insurance, you could be okay. But well, suppose that institution had a problem. Would you really want to have all your money in one institution? I mean, there's still some sort of argument to say it's all well and good to say I want to be in community banks. Well, sure. But maybe you don't want to have everything all in the same bank.
Well, Kevin, I'm going to let you step in and talk about that. Because, again, diversification is always a good thing. But Kevin just wrote something down for me, but I'm going to let him talk about that.
Well, when you read the fine print, so to speak, in the FDIC insurance coverage, if a bank fails, you may not necessarily be able to get your money out the next day. Mm-hmm. Now, in failures that have happened over the past few years, the banks have been open the next day for business, no problem has occurred, so on and so forth. But technically, they can delay withdrawals for up to 90 days under quote-unquote normal takeovers.
And what's really happened to date is you see that the banks get closed on Friday. Apparently, they have the so-called pizza party Friday night. And on Monday morning, the bank is reopened under a new name. And the FDIC has said, all right, bank, you get all the new deposits. And then we will have some kind of sharing in loss, which really means about 99% FDIC sharing in the loss, mm-hmm. and 1% to the new bank that takes over. So I believe up till now, at least, because we still have some positive balance in FDIC insurance, that people have had immediate access to their deposits, even though we have the 90-day rule.
Okay. Well, we'll talk some more in the next hour. All three of our guests, David Sinnoh, Kevin Waspy, John Nasidich, will all be here. We'll continue to take questions on money management. In just a moment, we'll bring you an update on the commodity markets. We want to update you on how we're doing this week and our fundraising effort. We set a goal. We'd said we'd like to hear from 1,000 pledges, and so far we're at 814, which is a pretty nice number. But we want to continue to forge on and see if we can hit that goal of 1,000. And you can be the next one on the list by giving us a call or going online. Dave Teal is here to help us out making the pitch for people who are listening.
Yeah, and that's terrific news. We're so happy to get over that 800 mark. And I think, it would be great if we could get all the way to, say, even 850 by the end of the next hour. I think that would be great. We can do that right now with your help, your phone call at 217-244-9455. And you may, think to yourself, well, what can I do? You know, it's my $40, my $100 isn't going to make that much of a difference. But it all adds up. And, I mean, we raise typically, in a typical year, a couple million dollars for public radio, public television here at Illinois Public Media. And it all comes in that way. That's how it comes in. $40 at a time, $100 at a time. Somebody makes a dollar a day contribution, $365 per year, and that all just becomes one big thing. And, right. And it goes to fun programs like this.
We think we're going to have to take a break now, as we usually do, so we can bring you an update on the commodity markets. But we hope that you will take the opportunity to go online or make a call and make a pledge to support the station this morning.